My guest, John Savage, is best known for chronicling the development of punk rock in his book, England's Dreaming. He's written extensively about pop culture. In his new book, Teenage, he traces the creation of youth culture and the idea of youth as a separate class with its own rituals, rights, and demands. He considers the book a prehistory of the teenager. It begins in 1875 and ends in 1945, the year after the word teenager becomes a common part of the American vocabulary. Music is an essential ingredient of what we've come to think of as youth culture. Savage says there are signs of young people having their own music in the early 20th century, but it's in the 1930s and 40s with swing that teenagers start to be identified with a particular style of music.
One of the great revelations to me in the book was researching and entering the world of swing, which I'd never really considered before. To me, it was the music of my parents' generation. And I was absolutely bowled over at how good it was. And I was also really struck by the descriptions of how popular it was and how it offered this kind of complete lifestyle. There was a whole language, and there was a whole way of speaking, there was a whole way of walking, there was a whole, you know, clothes, dancing. It really was, to me, one of the first really cohesive youth subcultures. But the interesting thing about all this, which goes back to your question, is the fact that none of the tunes that these people played actually talked about what it was to be young. They didn't say, I'm a teenager, I'm a jitterbugging teenager, or whatever. It was just, you know, standard stuff. They were just saying, you know, writing songs about dancing or writing songs about love. So you don't actually have this much evidence of a self-conscious, youthful, musical culture really before the end of the Second World War.
So that really starts with rock and roll.
Well, I don't think so quite. I think that there's evidence of it in R&B, you know, post-war R&B. There's a great track by the blues guitarist T-Bone Walker called Bobby Socks Baby from 1946, which is one of the first tracks I've been able to find that actually references self-consciously references youth culture. And there are songs about wild, wild young men, but basically, yes, it starts with much more with the advent of rock and roll, with tracks like 17 by Boyd Bennett, and obviously then going to I'm Not a Juvenile Delinquent by Frankie Lyman and Sweet Little 16 by Chuck Berry, etc., etc. And that shows how the advent of rock and roll really triggered much more coherent kind of youth self-consciousness and youth marketing indeed.
Now, you will always be associated with youth culture because you were one of the chief chroniclers of punk rock in the
yes.
in the 70s and 80s. And you know, you knew the bands, and you wrote about it in magazines and later in books. What did teen culture mean to you then?
Well, I was born in 1953, so I was very fortunate. The Beatles hit in the UK when I was 9, and that was it. And my entry point into all this was always music. I'm one of those people that I heard the Piper at a very young age, and I followed, and that was it. So I was very fortunate, really, to see the whole 60s thing as it happened, and then I just kept on following it. You know, I was glued to the television in those days, and I just saw everything happen, you know, Tamla Motown, the Byrds, Bob Dylan, the whole of the British, you know, invasion period, and it was just wild. And it was the only culture I had, really, because I was brought up in the suburbs of West London, and my parents weren't, you know, they were busy, you know, having a life and making a living and doing what they had to do. They weren't particularly interested in areas of culture. My mother was very interested in books, but they weren't interested in music. So I had the field to myself, really. And so as I became an adolescent, it was really everything to me. That's the world into which I would retreat. And that actually shaped the way that I saw the world. So I very much found out about the world through popular culture, particularly music, at a very young age, and I continue to do so for quite a long time.
I mean, music is one of the ways that youth culture not only tries to differentiate itself from its parents, but from previous youth cultures. I guess every generation of teenagers has its own music. So when you were writing about punk rock, and you know, by the time the Sex Pistols come along, you're already in your 20s.
I was 23 in 1976, which is just within the teenage catchment, which ends in 24. And also, you know, in some ways I was a late developer because in my actual adolescent years, I was busy studying. You know, I was very academically, I was a high flyer academically. And I was always taking exams. And then in the holidays, when I wasn't at school, I'd be wandering around central London with a friend or two. So I never had that thing that a lot of people have in adolescence, which is hanging around in gangs and going to clubs and stuff and getting into trouble. And I needed to do that. And so punk provided me with that arena. And also, I just loved the music. It wasn't an intellectual decision, oh, I'm going to get involved with this youth culture. I heard The Call again. I heard the Ramones album, and I went to see the Sex Pistols. And that was it. Bango, you know. And no thought about it. Just dive in.
Now, you changed your name from Sage to Savage.
That's right.
And I imagine you did that when you started writing about punk?
That's correct.
Tell us why you made the change. Now that you're an adult, how do you feel about having kept the name Savage, now that being Savage wouldn't be an important part of your professional personality?
Well, the immediate reason was that when I started writing about punk, I had actually had a day job. I was training to be a lawyer. And I would have got fired if they'd have found out what I was doing. And so I had to invent a pseudonym. And a friend of mine got my name wrong on the telephone in an interview he gave to a London paper. And so my name came out as John Savage. And I thought, oh, I like that. I'll keep that. And in retrospect, also, it's in the great tradition of pop transformation. You know, if you get involved with pop culture, you transform yourself. And you actually, a pseudonym is a very basic part of the process. I love having a pseudonym. It's great. Because, you know, I can put John Savage in a box and go home and be Jonathan Sage. And it's something that, you know, I'm totally used to now after 30 years. To be honest, I didn't really think about it.
So you never changed your name legally?
No. I would never do that. No. I mean, it's fun. It's supposed to be fun. It's pop, you know. It's the idea of changing your name. You think of all those Hollywood actors who change their names and all the British pop stars who change their names. You know, David Jones became David Bowie. So, and Savage was a great punk name. And, you know, I still have a bit of that about me. I can be Savage if I have to be.
As part of your research for this book, I think you talked to your father about what his teen culture was like. What are some of the things your father told you that you never knew about him?
Well, the great thing that my father said to me was that he was born in 1918. So when the war broke out in Europe, he was 21. And he had been convinced that there, 2 or 3 years before the war, that there's going to be a war with Hitler. So he joined the Territorial Army, which was like the reservists before the war. And he just knew there was going to be a war. And he had a very, very distinguished wartime career. He was involved in the Desert War in El Alamein, the Battle of El Alamein, and he won a Military Cross, which is quite a high honour in the UK. We were talking about all this, and in some ways it was the high spot of his life. And I think, knowing my father's character, I think it was very exciting for him, and actually it quite suited his personality. Even though he had to do very, very dangerous work. He was a sapper, an engineer, and he had to go and clear paths through the minefield, which is something that I just could not imagine. And he said to me that the war took six years out of his life, and then it took him another 6 years to get his life really back together again. Although he was working, although he was doing okay, he found the whole aftermath of the experience extremely difficult. And I think it marked him for the rest of his life. And I think one of the things that my generation has had to deal with and examine the damage that World War II did, not only really to Britain, I mean, I partly dealt with it in the book in Europe as well, is to examine the damage that was done in World War II, not to feel envy for the golden generation, but actually to try and unblock some of the emotions, some of the events that actually happened during that period.
Do you feel like you were personally shaped, or that your generation's culture in England was personally shaped by growing up in the aftermath of World War II?
I really do, Terry, yes, absolutely, absolutely centrally. If only on a physical level, during the punk period, for instance, I was working in the City of London in the financial district, and probably about a third of the City of London was still, vacant lots, were still bomb sites. And there was this particular flower that grew on the bomb site called Buddleia, which is a very sweet-smelling flower. And I remember just, acres and acres of bomb sites with this very sweet-smelling flower. It was a very bizarre juxtaposition. And I took some pictures of London at that period, and it just looks, they're black and white, and it just looks like a bomb site. It looks almost Dickensian Victorian in its squalor. So there's that physical aspect of it. And a lot of my heroes when I was younger, say like The Who or The Beatles or The Rolling Stones, for instance, were all actually born during the war. And, I think some of what they did was, in their music, was acting out the war damage. I really do. And that high volume and that violence that you hear in a lot of British music from that period, particularly in somebody like The Rolling Stones and The Who, The Beatles transmute it slightly, but it's still there. I was brought up in the suburbs, and the whole point about that was that it was almost like a tabula rasa. It was almost like an ideal environment where, nothing would happen, everything would be safe. And although I hated that when I was an adolescent, I now realize that was a very valid thing for my parents to do. It's perhaps one of the only things they could do because they'd just been through this terrible experience. And, I still talk about it with my mother, who still lives in London. And, when the whole, bombings happened in London, I said to her, how do you feel about this? Are you worried? And she started telling me...
You're talking about the subway bombings?
Yeah, the subway bombings, yes, July 7, 7-7, yeah. And when this happened, I said, how do you feel about this? Are you worried? And she said, oh, no, I remember when, there was a buzz bomb on those V1s, which were these pilotless bombs which would fly over London. And then they'd suddenly cut out. And it was when they cut out, you knew that they were going to fall to the ground. And she said, I remember being in the garden at home and one of these things came over and it aimed straight for us. And then just at the minute, it veered away and, hit a garden two or three houses down. So she'd lived through all this stuff, and she was very sanguine about it. She just said, if my number's up, my number's up. I'm not going to be scared by these bastards.
My guest is John Savage. He chronicled the history of punk rock in his book, England's Dreaming. His new book, Teenage, is about the creation of youth culture. I'm wondering if you have children and if your decision to or not to have children was affected at all by your kind of prolonged period of being immersed in youth culture and being identified with teen culture and all the kind of music rebellions that came along with that.
Well, Terry, I'm never going to have kids because I'm gay, so, that's just not going to happen.
Well, you could still adopt.
No. I think that for whatever reason, I knew early on that I wasn't going to have children. Mm-hmm. And so obviously, in a way, yes, absolutely dealing with this topic is, one way of experiencing that whole facet of life. I mean, I do have to reiterate that, I don't actually live like an adolescent in my life. I do live like an adult. So this is very much, to some extent, work for me. It's not something that I have I do distinguish my own personal life from my professional life and the work that I do. It's very important for me to do that. And again, that's encoded in the difference between, my real name and my pseudonym. Absolutely. I think, and I do find it very interesting that I can give insights to my friends who do have children. I'm staying with friends at the minute in New York who do have children. We talk about it a lot, adolescent children, in fact, just coming to the upper limit of adolescence. And we've talked about it a lot over the years, and I can sometimes offer insights, because I've studied the whole thing so carefully and I have, I'm abstracted from the situation. I'm not in the emotionally involved. And again, they tell me things that they do, and I spend time with, their children. And so it's all very interesting. I feel perfectly happy about it.
Just curious, during the punk period, I don't know if you were out then or not, but did you feel that punk culture was on the whole open to people who were gay and out, that there was a place for that within punk?
That's a very good question. I think absolutely not. In fact, there were a lot of gay people involved with punk, both in the UK and in the US, and absolutely none of them were out. The only person who was out in the UK was a singer called Tom Robinson, who wasn't really punk, who was new wave, and these things really mattered then. And actually, he was very brave, and I really appreciate him now, but at the time, I absolutely hated his music, which was just very, I found very boring. So although punk was a movement of outcasts, which it was in the early stage, for some reason it was quite pure. It had a very Puritan aspect anyway. A lot of punks were not particularly involved with sex, or said they weren't particularly involved with sex. And for some reason, I think probably as a reaction against the previous sort of glammed glitter rock generation, which was, you know, very much promoted bisexuality, I think there was a certain amount of homophobia and intolerance. You know, there's a song by the Sex Pistols called New York, where they talk about, you know, poor little faggot, and I never noticed it then. But, you know, now it really grates. And I didn't have much sense of my own gay identity at the time, even though, in fact, it was extremely important to me. So that's something I've really thought about quite a lot in the intervening years.
So what was it like for you during that period when you're part of this culture and you're changing your name to John Savage and it's like, this is who I am, this is what I'm about, except a fundamental part of who you are and what you're about can't be included in this part of teen culture?
Yes, well, when people ask me about the punk period, it was obviously on one level incredibly exciting. On one level, it was, you know, the time that formed me, the time that enabled me to write, which is what I'd always wanted to do. And I suddenly, you know, I conceived of the idea. I had a real problem when I was studying for law and I had to do these exams and I hated it. And I thought, well, what do you want to do, Clever Clogs? You know, okay, it's all very well to say you hate this. What do you actually want to do? And I thought, well, I want to write. And then 6 months after thinking that and making that decision, I was doing it. And then I was able to do it for a national music newspaper called Sounds. And that was, you know, and we were reaching probably 500,000 kids every week. It was insane, the exposure that you got. So on one level, it was just fantastic. I was seeing all these incredible bands, incredible groups, performances, and I was in the swing of this thing, and I was writing, which is what I'd always wanted to do. And on another level, it was as though I was emotionally frozen. And in some ways, I was incredibly unhappy and incredibly frustrated. And also at that point, I was taking, you know, I was taking drugs like, you know, you did in rock and roll in that period, and that didn't help either. And so, you know, it wasn't that when people ask me about punk, I say, well, it was very exciting, but it wasn't a personally happy time.
Having completed this really large book on the creation of youth culture, would you ever now want to be a teenager again, or are you glad to be way beyond that?
I'm really happy to be way beyond it. Thank you, Terry. I'm really, really, really happy. I mean, I just think you have to be who you are, be where you are, not want to be somebody different. It's okay to want to be somebody different when you're young, when you can experiment. But when, you know, when you're 53, you've got to be pretty grounded. Otherwise, you've got serious problems. And I have no desire to be a teenager again. I think that would be, you know, beyond nature in a very, very dangerous way. And in fact, you know, this goes back to the book and the parables in the picture of Dorian Gray and in Peter Pan about eternal youth. It's disastrous. It's incredibly toxic. And within our culture in general, there's, you know, a lot of people trying to prolong their youth, you know, in disastrous ways. It just doesn't work. You know, the human body has finite limits.
Well, John Savage, thanks so much for talking with us.
Okay, Terry, it was a pleasure.
John Savage is the author of the new book, Teenage, The Creation of Youth Culture.